All right, you have until tonight at midnight to do the Chapter 7 assignment. Chapter 8 is due next Wednesday, Chapter 9 due next Friday. Get a start on the Chapter 8 one well before Wednesday, because you're going to want to spend next week working on the Chapter 9 one. Ready? Anybody have any questions? You got 2 more weeks worth of experimentation in your lab projects, so I'll be coming by talking to the groups on Monday again. So make sure we're in the right area. We're measuring the right stuff. We've got our probes calibrated correctly. That type of stuff. So, anybody have any questions? All right. So. We have a little bit of Chapter 8 to finish up talking about. I've got another little problem for us to do after that. I've got a demonstration to show you, then I'll start to talk at least a little bit about Chapter 9, just to get us starting to think about that. But we won't spend too much time on Chapter 9. I'll have the blank notes for 9 ready for you to go before class on Monday. So. We were talking about ions before we ended last time. We talked about the electron configurations of ions. We talked about the size of ions. Turns out whether it's a plus ion or a minus ion makes a big difference as to its size, correct? If it's generally around the same, if it's in the same row on the periodic table, let's put it that way, what's going to be bigger, a plus ion or a minus ion? Think about what's happening to electrons. Yeah. If it's a plus ion, what has happened to some electrons? We've lost electrons, so we've cleared out that outer shell, pretty much. So in a minus ion, you're adding electrons to that same shell, and when all you're doing is adding electrons to the same place without adding anything in the nucleus, what do those electrons do to each other? Yeah, they spread out, they repel each other. So in the same row, what's bigger, a plus ion or a minus ion? Minus, definitely. So, have that general trend about the size of ions down. Let's combine some of our talk about energy, right, delta H, stuff like that, with now the reaction of an ion that's forming. So let's talk about the energy involved when an ion forms. So let's start with ionization energy. Energy required to remove one electron from an atom or ion. I say energy required to remove an electron. If I just have an electron, okay, and I have something like a sodium atom, right? Well, let's think about that a little differently. Sodium, what's sodium's valence electron configuration? You guys want your periodic tables back?
Yeah. Or S1. Here. Who wants the periodic table back?
What is sodium's valence electron configuration? 3s1. I'll put it up above. Okay. And when sodium becomes an ion, what happens in terms of what we wrote up there? That electron is removed, right? That electron goes away. Sodium makes Na plus. What if I want to make this a balanced chemical equation? Sodium becomes Na plus and plus one electron. All right. That's balanced in terms of atoms, of course, but it's also balanced in terms of charge. A properly balanced chemical equation when we're forming an ion will have the charges balanced. Right? You see how the charges have balanced in this one? What happens to the plus and the minus? Yeah, having a plus and the minus is the same as having a neutral on the other side. That just makes sure no electrons are appearing or disappearing. Right? So, think about this. Energy required to remove one electron from an atom or ion. Why is energy required in order to remove that one electron from the sodium? Yeah. Between what and what? Yeah. There's an attraction between the nucleus and any electrons. It's a misconception to think that because it has that extra valence electron and it forms an Na plus readily, that that one electron just flies away. It requires energy to pull it away, just like it requires energy to pull two magnets apart from each other by the north and south pole. Right? It requires some real energy to pull those apart. So anytime an electron is being separated from an atom, no matter how favorable we would consider that, it always requires energy to pull two opposite charges apart from each other. Okay? There are very few absolute things in chemistry and physics, but that is one thing. It is actually required. Energy is required. So that's ionization energy, and specifically that is the first ionization energy. Okay? 496 kilojoules are required to remove one electron from a mole of sodium atoms. Okay? If I have Na plus, what is Na plus's electron configuration? It's a full shell. It's the same as what? Same as neon. If I wanted to pretend that I could, well, I can. It's not very favorable, but if I wanted to try to remove an additional electron, it's not something that we're going to normally consider doing, but it's something we can consider, right? We remove that one outermost electron, but what happens if I keep going? What happens if I remove another electron after that? What does Na plus become if I try to remove another electron? Na 2 plus? And one electron. What do you suppose IE2 is called? That is the second ionization energy. Okay. Why is IE2 almost 10 times larger than IE1 for sodium? That's right. Sodium plus is stabilized because, why? What did you say? Because it has 8 valence electrons. All of the noble gases on the right hand of your periodic table have 8 valence electrons. That's a stable arrangement of electrons because it's symmetrical, in other words. Okay. If I remove an additional electron beyond that, I break that symmetry. So the atom no longer has that extra stabilization. So why does that make for a larger number for IE2?
It takes a lot more energy to pull away.
Absolutely. It takes 10 times more energy to pull that second one away than it does to pull the first one away. Right? So typically, here, let's see if we can figure out a trend here. From sodium to magnesium, right? Let's just keep going. Ionization energy is only talking about removing electrons one at a time. So let's do the first. What will be formed as a product in the reaction that represents the first ionization energy of magnesium? Mg plus. Plus what? One electron. Look at my explanation in purple. Okay. That explanation in purple represents the relationship of this 738 number to what other number that I have up here?
496.
Yeah, 496. Okay. It is almost twice as difficult to remove well, not 1.5 times, to remove one electron from magnesium as it is to remove one from sodium, because additional protons across a period, see where magnesium is in relation to sodium? One more proton, right? Extra pull between the electrons and the nucleus. What other property was caused by that? Radius, yeah, size. As you go to the right, there's extra pull that condenses the electron cloud in. That also makes it more difficult to remove the first electron.
Is there ever a case of the second initial energy is less than the first one?
Is less than the first if there is if there's additional stabilization offered by removing the second one, then I guess it's possible. So. Yeah, that is balanced, though. That's counterbalanced by the fact that we're going from a plus charge to a more plus charge. Yeah, that. So when we're talking about where electrons and stuff are going, the further we get away from having electrons and protons next to each other, the more difficult it gets. So there's two sort of counterbalancing effects in there that can get pretty complicated. So we can't routinely, I guess, always. I mean, usually it will be like, especially in that case, usually it'll be more difficult to remove electrons the further along.
The activation energy, if you apply that much energy to say first activation energy to sodium, would it only emit an electron in the presence of another substance?
There usually needs to be a place for the There usually needs to be a place for that electron to go. The ionization energy itself, we'll learn in, especially in the next chapter, it happens in conjunction with something else gaining an electron, and there's an energy change associated with that. But it is helpful for us to try, you know, through several experiments with different substances, you can back out what the actual energy change is associated with just this process, even though this exact process here probably won't happen on its own. Right? There has to be somewhere for that electron to go.
So is the energy listed there, does that remove one electron out of all the atoms in one mole, or does it remove one electron from each atom?
From every, yeah. That's kilojoules per mole of electrons, essentially. Yeah, that's a good question. Okay. So first ionization for potassium, K plus, plus one electron. Are these two explanations starting to look familiar? Okay. Pretty much going across and going down, we'll always have these sort of these two explanations when we're talking about periodic properties. So potassium is where in relationship to sodium on the periodic table?
One.
Yeah, it's one down. Okay. Whenever you go down one row, that means you add what? Yeah, and what in terms of electrons? Yeah, specifically a whole, another entire principal energy level, right? Another entire shell. So so the distance of electrons becomes further out on average. An additional shell shields the valence electrons from the nuclear attraction. If there's now more electrons in between the one we're removing and the nucleus, there will be less effective nuclear charge. Okay? So the more shells there are between the valence electron and the nucleus, the easier it is to remove, the harder it is?
Easier.
Okay? Does this 419 agree with something being easier to remove? Compare that 419 to what? Yeah, 496. It's not a lot, but it's... but it's an actual quantifiable difference, okay, that you can gauge that way. Okay. So you should know those two trends. Okay. I won't worry too much about going beyond the first ionization energy. Okay. But now as you go across the row, it gets more difficult because there's more attraction. Okay? As you go down, it gets easier because the electron you're removing is further out and it's shielded from the nucleus. IE2. No, I said IE2. It should be IE1. Yeah, it looks like a typo to me. There you go. For potassium. Yeah, 419 is IE1. Okay. Other questions about this? All right. So.
Andy.
Yeah.
Are those numbers determined by the quantum numbers, like the energy? Is there like a formula for each that determines it based on quantum numbers?
Those numbers were, I'm sure, experimental in some manner. What you can do is take several reactions and then a sort of Hess's law type thing. You can back out that individual relationship. There is computational chemistry, I'm sure, which could get something close to that, but I'm sure those numbers are experimental. Okay, so let's get some reactions. There's some pictures. I've actually got some alkali metals. I'll show them to you here in a second. Before we do that, take a look at the reaction of lithium with water. Alkali metals, lithium, sodium, potassium, they react with water. We've talked about that a little bit before. Here is the balanced chemical equation for what's happening. Okay. Think for just a moment. Is lithium oxidized or reduced? Don't say it out loud. I sort of give you a hint in the first one right here, but for a moment, is lithium oxidized or reduced? Ask yourself, what do you ask yourself when you're doing oxidized or reduced? Did it what or did it what? Did it gain electrons or did it lose electrons? Okay, did lithium gain or lose electrons? Lost? Yeah, it lost one electron. So that means lithium was oxidized. Yeah. These are all oxidations. It says LiOH here. How do we know lithium lost an electron when it became LiOH? Yeah, because it's lithium plus and OH negative, correct? Okay. If I was balancing these equations, what do they all need? Plus one electron. Okay. I'll give you ionization energies here. First ionization energy for each of these. Lithium, 520. Okay. So let's see if you remember. Should sodium be larger or smaller than that?
Smaller.
496. Had these numbers on the last page. Potassium should be smaller yet. 419. That was the last number we had. All right. And those numbers get smaller. Why? Further and further away. They're shielded by the inner electrons. Okay. So it becomes easier or harder to remove? As we go down, it becomes easier to remove one. Okay? Which of these three reactions is the most favorable energetically? Potassium is the most favorable energetically because it requires the least amount of energy. Okay? These are all oxidations. Okay? So if this is an oxidation, what kind of agent are lithium, sodium, potassium? If lithium, sodium, potassium themselves get oxidized, that makes them what kind of agent? They are reducing agents. Right? So, which is the strongest? Oops. Which of these three, lithium, sodium, or potassium, is the strongest reducing agent? The strongest reducing agent is the one that is most likely to become oxidized, right? Remember, if something is an agent, the other thing happens to it. Okay? The strongest reducing agent is the one where it's most favorable to be oxidized, and you told me that one was what? Potassium, right. So, we just used a little bit of quantum mechanics there to explain why an element down further on the periodic table is a stronger reducing agent than one up above. Okay? It is, potassium is more likely to favorably undergo oxidation. It's more likely to reduce something else that you put with it. Okay? What is being reduced when I react it with water? Whenever there's an oxidation, there has to be a reduction. It's not oxygen. Oxygen is minus 2 on the left and the right. It's hydrogen. Okay? What's hydrogen's oxidation number in water? Plus 1?
Yeah.
Because there are 2 plus 1s and 1 minus 2 that make water 0. Right? What's hydrogen's oxidation number over in H2? 0. Okay? So of these three, potassium is the most able to reduce the hydrogen in water to H2 gas. Okay? So if I were to say have samples of lithium, sodium, and potassium, which one should have the most vigorous reaction? Let's see. Why do we have to be so careful about storing these things? Yeah, they're reactive with water, as we see in that right there. Why can't we just, why can't I just keep it in something like this? There's, water's not going to get in there, right? Yeah, humidity in the air will slowly react with it and deactivate it, turn it into lithium hydroxide, something like that. Maybe I should have kept this down on the floor there. Maybe we'll see it a little better. All right. Let's do that. I should be able to see that. Got some forceps here. I'll show these to you. They all look pretty similar. They're just kind of gray metals. It's stored in mineral oil, sort of a thick oil, again, to keep what from happening? Yeah, air, water vapor, okay, any of those things from being reduced. Okay. It's pretty dark on the outside because of, even stored under the oil, right, or from when we take it out, right, there's a coating of that hydroxide that forms on the surface.
Which one is that?
This is lithium. So I'm just going down the row. Yeah, and a lot of us know that. These are fairly soft. All I need to do is take a spatula. Lithium is a little harder than the other ones, but take a knife for a spatula and cut it. But
just look at the inside. You all see that? The shine on that, on the inside. Very shiny. Here, I can move it so it reflects. Okay? That dull sort of outer surfacing is the lithium hydroxide that's formed just from water vapor. Yeah. But really itself is very shiny on the inside. If I were to leave it out, though, that shiny part would eventually dull up here. Don't use forceps with your non-dominant hand. So, before I put it in water, hydrogen gas should be evolved. Well, we all know what that looks like.
But lithium hydroxide is formed. How do we classify hydroxides?
Basics.
Yeah, hydroxides are basic. So I could verify that with some phenolphthalein. Okay. Phenolphthalein is colorless in acidic solution. And remember what color it is in basic solution? Pink. You guys used that in your... Okay. Just the little bit I had on the surface of the spatula. Let you see that a little bit. So let's put this chunk of lithium in there. It's not tremendously interesting, but you know, it bubbles, it fizzes, and that pink color is an indication of what? Base? What's the base here? Lithium hydroxide that's formed. Okay. So we'll have exhausted the phenolphthalein's ability to turn color anymore just with this first one. But it fizzes, you know, it bubbles, probably about the same rate as the Alka-Seltzer that you guys are doing, except Alka-Seltzer doesn't give off hydrogen gas. Right? It also... Well, it spits out a little bit of lithium hydroxide as a suspended solid. So... Usually bring a watch glass to cover it up with. I'll use a smaller piece with the other stuff. But... So I probably shouldn't light up a cigarette right now up here. Right? All right. It's a big room, it'll disperse. I hope. All right. Sodium.
I don't bring it to
So this lump here looks different, okay? But sodium itself looks pretty much the same as lithium. Why does this look different? Are we looking at sodium here? Yeah, we're looking at a solid coating of sodium hydroxide, which is a white solid. Lithium hydroxide is kind of grayish, sort of a dull color. I'll get just a little piece of sodium off here to give you an idea. But it's very soft. Cuts like, you know, yeah, like butter. So, little piece of sodium. Oh, there's a smoke ring. It skips along on the surface. Right? It forms hydrogen much faster, so it actually kind of floats on a little cushion of hydrogen and sort of skips along on the surface. So, just a tiny little piece there. Oh, and when it's this real tiny, it's just kind of darting around. Right on the surface. It doesn't get much below that. So reacts much faster. No. Do it.
Don't have a few days to clean up.
Yeah. Got the break, right? All right. A little piece of potassium. So if it's absorbent clay, so if some water does drip in there, the clay would absorb it before it got to the bottle. There was actually a fire 5 or 6 years ago at a plant that produces solid sodium and potassium. So the fire department comes and sprays water on it, which... But, you know, you kind of have to wonder what else, you know, it's not a whole lot else to do. They can't, I mean, they could try to dump sand on it or something, but...
Can you spray fire-retarding foam on it and get it?
That would probably be the best, but really what it is...
Fire, too.
Yeah. I mean, really, those foams aren't even so good for alkali metals. Really, the only thing you can do is dump sand on it just to cover it up and not let it get in contact with anything else. I mean, it does not need oxygen to react either. So CO2 or something like that isn't going to help. But an acid. No, an acid would make it go faster because that'll react with the hydroxide and make the reaction produce more hydroxide. So I don't think that would help either. So here's some potassium. What was the flame you saw there? Why was there flame there? Hydrogen gas was being produced. Okay, the reaction gave off enough heat that the hydrogen started to combust. So if you had a big piece and the room was dark, the flame would actually be purple because that's the ground state, or that's the electrons rising and falling for potassium. You see that purple color when something with potassium in it is burned. So I only use tiny little pieces of those other ones, but you still get the idea that the trend of reactivity is that way. And all that is because as they get bigger, the electrons are easier to remove because they're further away. They're shielded from the nuclear charge, more or less, like that. I don't want to dump this down in again. Yeah, that's why alkali metals are so interesting, and why we have to store them in those paint cans with kitty litter and.
What did you have in the other cans?
I think those were. See, I wasn't sure which ones were full and which ones were empty. So
okay.
There were a couple of each, but nice picture that you guys couldn't see in there. But their sodium actually starts on fire a little bit. If you use a big enough piece, you can get some flame to come from sodium. Okay. Let's see here. Before we go on to electron affinity, though, let me actually show you something. We got plenty of time here. I can show you guys a couple of things interesting and related to this. Get some sound plugged in. So this guy, Theodore Gray, if you physics people have ever used Mathematica, he's the founder of the company that does that. But he's also well known in chemistry circles for having a complete collection of elements, which he does all kinds of experiments on and captures all kinds of different properties and videos, and he has his website anyway has one of the most complete collections of videos and pictures and information about the pure elements themselves. So he actually made a periodic table, an actual table that has the elements in it. That's why it's this carved wood here. It's linked from mine, theodoregray.com is his name. Let's see here. Which one was one I want to show you? Here we go. This is him releasing a large chunk of it into a lake. Yeah. Let's see if we get sound here. Oops. Yeah. Get in a little kiddie pool sitting on it. You guys catch that? It's not just one explosion. Here.
It shut it so high.
So instead of all reacting at once, it did sort of like the little piece did, where it floated on a layer of hydrogen, except when you have a big piece, it produces so much hydrogen that it propels it up out of the water. So what's typical if it were a baseball sized lump of sodium to lob it into the lake, it would go boom and then boom, boom. It does it, you know, 6, 7, 8 times, breaks into smaller and smaller pieces, and hopefully doesn't take anybody out that's watching on the side of the lake.
How much does pure sodium cost?
It's very expensive. Yeah. Here. Here it is at night, you can see the flame a little better. That one scared somebody. What they used to do at the University of Minnesota, you know, they'd have chunks of sodium for demonstration, but after it gets so old, it's not so good for demonstration anymore, and it's expensive to dispose of properly, so they would take it on the bridge that goes over the Mississippi River there, and they'd just drop it off down into the river, and that was a big big tradition for them to have up until 2001 or so, when it was post 9/11. Somebody saw an explosion in the river and got panicked, and cop cars and SWAT team and all that kind of stuff came surrounding the whole bridge in the river. The bridge was closed, and so they're not allowed to dispose of sodium that way anymore. There's one other thing I want to show you, but it'll tie into, there you go. It'll tie into the discussion I want to have after this. So there you go.
Why don't you bless Roy Stenasco? You can appreciate the sheer fun, mayhem that chemistry can be. There's so much to it. Bunsen burners, mixing chemicals.
Very nice.
Now, you may have been allowed to mix very small amounts of lithium with water. You may, if with a responsible adult, have mixed H2O with sodium. And you may, under very strict scientific control, have witnessed potassium mixed with water. The odds are, if you have, it will only ever have been on one of those rubbish science videos. There you go, my friend.
Potassium actually does detonate like that if you have a piece bigger than the little bit that I put in there. So much hydrogen will build up that all of a sudden it combusts sort of all at once.
These next two are the dog's nuts of the periodic table. They are, if you like, the king and queen of alkaline metals. Mix these babies with water, stand well back, and watch some mayhem. And that's just what we're going to do. Mr. Tickle, bring on the rubidium.
Here it is.
So based on what we know, rubidium is next on the periodic table. Eh? What should happen?
A little bit of smoke.
Is that it?
Well, it might not look like much, Richard, but it's a highly reactive metal. It's sealed in this glass tube under argon atmosphere conditions, just for safety.
Right, so what's going to happen when you drop that in the water?
Well, imagine, if you will, letting off a hand grenade in a bathtub.
Righto, I'm off. Have that.
Okay, good luck.
Good luck.
Okay, Tickle, drop the rubidium in the water.
Stand back, everyone.
2 grams of rubidium will only react when our specially designed vial dissolves in the water, which gives John a few crucial seconds to get into our safety zone. Yes! Oh, that is more like it. Only on brain you get that kind of... science, but I believe we can go one better. There is one more alkali metal we can legally use.
Yes, so good cesium, the emperor of alkali metals, particularly now, seems to go up at any time.
And that's it. Oh, yes, I like it already. Now, what's that going to do when it hits the water? Imagine a death charge in a bathtub. Round of mate, I'll leave it. Thank you. Okay, Jack, go for it.
Burning, 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 extreme energy,
clear the air. As that cesium sinks in the water, the rapid generation of hydrogen gas should produce quite an explosion. And it does. Magnificent. I think that concludes today's experiment. There is, I should say, one more, even more reactive metal, francium. But for some reason, they wouldn't let us have any of that. There you go. Today's lesson. Never mix alkaline metals with water.
So, there is a little issue, though. Let's go back to sodium here, and let's see here. It is. There's potassium. Or no, I want rubidium. There we go. So, this guy here, you know, we saw him before. You know, we were all really fascinated by this video. It was, and it goes along with the reactivity trend that we talked about. And it's lots of fun. But let's see here. Where is his... Well, anyway, I can't find the video on here. It's not nearly as he sort of tried to replicate what happened in the Brainiac video. So he took 2 or 3 grams of cesium, or this is rubidium. He actually did it with cesium as well. And the thing that makes the story interesting and kind of a bummer is that he took rubidium, 3 grams, put it in a bathtub or something like that, and it fizzed and bubbled. He did the same thing with cesium. There was a little bit of flame, but it just sort of fizzed and bubbled. So, who's right and who's wrong here? At first he thought it was a purity issue, but could those Brainiac people get purer samples of cesium and rubidium than this guy? I don't think so. I think that was just how it was in an ampule that dissolved so that the water could get to it after a certain amount of time.
They said it wasn't regular air.
Yeah, it was pressurized.
In a pressurized container or something like that? Yeah, that could be here. And it has such a low melting point, cesium, anyway, that it melts in your hand. Oh, here he says it. Okay. I saw the British TV setting off 2 gram ampules. They got huge explosions, much better than mine. I wondered what I did wrong. Then I read these 2 articles in the highly respected Guardian newspaper. Sky claims that viewers are always told when the results of experiments are jazzed up. All right. But what really happened? So, cesium, they had an explosion. What really happened? Absolutely nothing. The cesium entered it, hit the bottom of the bath like a lead weight. Sheer volume of water then drowned out the thermal shockwave I was expecting. They could not go home empty-handed, so they rigged a bomb to the bottom of the bath, and they blew the shit out of it. It was saved to look cool. It ate away my conscience, but I couldn't do anything about it. So yeah, it was interesting. It sort of proved our point about reactivity down the periodic table, but what's actually going on here? Why the heck didn't cesium and rubidium react like they should have? Let's see if you guys can figure it out. It's actually a little simpler chemistry that explains why those ones don't react. What happens to mass as you go down the periodic table? It increases, okay? So if we had standard samples, if we had 2 gram or 3 gram samples of lithium, sodium, potassium, rubidium, and cesium, if I had 2 grams of each of those, what happens to the number of metal atoms? Way less. Look at potassium to rubidium. 2 grams of potassium will have like twice as many atoms as 2 grams of rubidium, right? And it'll have, you know, almost, so four times, you know, three, four times as many as cesium. Molar mass increases, right, by quite a bit, by one whole row's worth on the periodic table. So maybe you would get an increasing result if you had a constant number of atoms of cesium. Yeah. But again, you would need to have, to get something interesting with potassium, you'd have to have, 5-10 pounds of it, something like that. So you'd need 20 pounds of rubidium and 50 pounds of cesium to see the actual change in reactivity that's due just to the elements themselves. So we were all so excited about this video, and then somebody started thinking, wait a minute here. If you have the same mass of each of those, how on earth could such a small number of cesium atoms produce enough hydrogen to explode it like that? So it was actually just some kind of plastic explosive that they stuck to the bottom. But at least you're going to remember the important part, that the reactivity increases going down the periodic table. It's complicated by the fact that mass increases too. So, all right, that's it for that. That took the rest of our time, so that's good. Have a nice Thanksgiving. We'll see you Monday.